From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for March 26, 2021. Baseball is back. This Thursday, it's the Brewers' home opener with the Minnesota Twins. And the hottest team in the NBA, your Milwaukee Bucks, are at the Forum tonight and Saturday night with the Celtics and the Knicks. For the rest of the year, Krispy Kreme Donuts is giving away free donuts anytime, any day, at any Krispy Kreme. All you need to do is show your vaccination card and, of course, have a permission slip from your cardiologist. And for the first time during the pandemic, liquor sales are down. Now we're talking free donuts and cheap liquor. Here's your headline of the week. Angry customer demands a refund after ordering a dozen face masks, but received only 12. Yeah, math can be hard. Here's the strangest Florida story of all, the strange Florida stories I've done. Parents used cocaine and pot as a bargaining chip to get their kids to do household chores. There has to be something in the water down there. And finally, a man in Poland has failed his driver's license test 192 times. And I'm shocked this didn't happen in Florida, the home of the perpetual turn signal. On the podcast today, we have Dave Sandstrom, Joel Dreesing, Paige Ratke, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Max, I'm really proud of that individual in Poland for sticking at it. You'd think maybe after 190, he might have given up, but he keeps going for it. So
it's shooting for 200, I think.
Well, a good week overall for markets, or at least a more stable week overall for markets than what we've seen. Not positive numbers, but certainly after what had been a rough middle of the week, to recover some Thursday and Friday was a big deal. The NASDAQ down 0.2%, closing today at the bell at 13,110. The S&P 500 down 0.2%, down 6 points for the week to close at 3968. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closing at the bell up 407 points today at 33,026, down 0.1% for the week. For the year, the NASDAQ now up just 1.9% for the year. Broader markets, though, the S&P up 6%, to the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 8.4%. Just a quick look at the 10-year Treasury. It moved lower this week from 1.73% down to 1.66. We had seen as high as upper 1.7% last week. And so a step back on the 10-year, I think just a sign that maybe things had gotten a bit of them ahead of themselves there. Hopefully, for bond investors, at least, see things trade in a more tight range now for the 10-year for a little while. But the move higher certainly has disrupted bond portfolios, at least short term. You know, as we jump into this week, I think important to remember a year ago, March 23rd, 2020, the S&P 500 bottomed in the quickest bear market that we had ever seen. And this article is going to go out this afternoon with our newsletter. But in addition to that, I thought it was worth pointing out just how quick not only did stocks go from bull to bear, did they go from what had been a pretty meaningful run all the way up until mid-February of last year. But again, in the span of roughly a month, we lost not only the 20% bear market, but significantly more. Stocks at their worst down 33.9%, the S&P 500 was. And if you look at what's happened since, so just 1 year after that bottom, the S&P 500 had gained 74.8%. And so for investors, just looking at that rolling one-year statement, if you pulled it up on March 23rd of this year, things look far better than maybe what most people were expecting. Of course, I think it's not fair to just measure things from the bottom. It's so rare for investors to capture only the bottoms and tops of markets. And again, that's much of what is going out in the newsletter today, is talking about just how big of a challenge market timing really is. But I think important to at least highlight just how good of a year it's been. Dave, as you look back at the last year, certainly we've learned quite a bit, about how to navigate a pandemic. But, it seems like no matter what happened, stocks found a way to make money.
So Kyle, you pointed out a couple of very interesting stats there. And you would talk about the fastest decline into a bear market in history. I mean, we're talking about 200 years of data here, looking back over the stock market. And, you know, one thing in that we followed that with, I believe, was a record ascent into a bull market in a matter of just several weeks. So kind of gives you an idea of how unique this pandemic was for investors that are actually alive today. Nobody, you know, most people have not experienced a pandemic. And to see the global economy shut down overnight, it just had such an impact on the markets. And your point about the, you know, how far we've come since then, just another great reminder of why we don't try to time markets, why we don't want to get ourselves in a situation where we panic in a market sell-off and make a decision that, you know, arguably could be, you know, really devastating to your portfolio over the long haul. So by sticking with a plan and staying invested throughout this, you can see how fortunate you've been to get back to this point. So just, you know, broad optimism coming here. And I think it's been a remarkable run here over the last 12 months.
Maybe just to put a finer point on that, the average recovery peak to peak since 1960 is about 3.5 years. That the stock market peak followed by that bear market, it takes about 3.5 years to get it back. We did it in 6 months this time, and that's absolutely the shortest that we've seen. And so I think investors who reacted, even if you only reacted for a short point in time, take, you know, the bad luck of selling on the absolute worst possible day. So March 23rd of last year, you decide you've had enough and you decide to get out of the market. You wait a month and things start to feel a little better. As you mentioned, we were back in a bull market, you know, at least from the bottom by that point. So think peak to peak right now, you're up about 15.5% from where we were the end of the last peak to where we are now. If you had taken just a month off, starting at the absolute bottom of the market, you're still down 7.6% in your portfolio. And so we're not talking about a lot of trading days here. We're talking about, you know, the difference between when you felt really bad about the markets at their absolute worst and when you felt really, you know, like things had at least turned a little bit of a corner a market later. And there was nothing about, you know, that market bottom or the a month later or 6 months after that where all of a sudden we knew that everything was all clear. And that's typical of these kinds of periods of volatility. Yeah, this one happened more quickly than the rest. You know, I do think it's fair to say that, you know, we just don't know what's going to be the catalyst for things to turn around. And so time out of the market is detrimental to the part of your portfolio that should be invested in stocks. And that's different for every investor. That's different based on what you need your portfolio for and how quickly you need it. But just about everybody needs a little piece of that portfolio at a minimum in stocks.
Kyle, I just happened to read an article that you wrote for our website that's published that we put on the website back in last January, in January of 2020. And don't cringe, because, you know, sometimes it's painful to go back and read what you wrote before, but it ended. I mean, so this is, you know, I mean, we're talking about 12 months or a dozen months, if for those of us who know what a dozen is, you know, since the coronavirus really kind of took course. But that column in January of 2020 was about this virus that was, you know, starting to make headlines coming out of China and sort of saying, you know, some people are kind of scared about this. We don't know where it's going, but it ended up, and I'm quoting here now, it says, short-term movements mean little to long-term investors. A properly balanced portfolio and an insistence on quality, especially in bonds, allows investors to progress beyond today's headlines to what matters for their long-term success. And you know, like I say, I mean, you know, you can read that now and look at, and you know, I mean, the pandemic is a big thing. And it's, as you point out in the article that you have in the newsletter that's going out today, the pandemic is still going. But really, that's been a really relatively short-term event so far.
Yeah, Joel, a lot of help from you in making me sound really smart in that one last January, the one that's going out again today. But, you know, I stick to those words. I wouldn't put stuff out there if I didn't think that it had some lasting power, and good to see, you know, a year and a couple months later that still seems to make some sense. Hey, Paige, we spent a bit of time the past couple of weeks that I've been on talking about, you know, some of the challenges that growth stocks have faced because of rising interest rates. You know, you sent me a great article or a great research piece from a firm that you know that talked about some of the benefits of, you know, maybe where we are in the current economic cycle and what that means for some cyclical stocks. I wonder, you know, what some of your takeaways are from some of the challenges we've seen with some of the names that had been doing well. And I think more importantly, what some of the opportunities have been for some of those names that maybe hadn't.
Yeah. So I think, you know, again, going back to the pandemic and looking at last year when everything first started to turn, the biggest concern at that time was those cyclical stocks. And it was very much a defense on, you wanted to go into those things that you knew were going to have solid earnings or at least consistent earnings, regardless of what the current economic situation was. And as we've come out of that, we've seen those more cyclical names start to rally. And again, you know, not only looking at it from a good economic news standpoint, but also looking at it from a valuation standpoint, those defensive names became very overvalued as everybody started to pile into them, whereas the cyclicals got a little bit left behind. And we've seen that start to turn around. But again, you know, going forward, as we start to see interest rates, which, you know, we've seen them rise on the short term and the long term, whether or not the Fed's going to start increasing, that will make a difference too. But all of these things start to bode well for those more cyclical sides. As, you know, as we come out of this pandemic, I'd expect that to be a place where we'd see things outperforming.
You know, Paige, I think that's such a great point. And, you know, so many positives on the cyclical side of the market. You look at something like financials, which is tied to the activity of the economy. Financials are benefiting as rates have risen because they can get more on their deposits with the Fed, and they're still not offering all that attractive of an interest rate if you want to buy a CD, if you want to, you know, put it in a savings account. And then you add in that the Treasury is allowing them now to do some more share buybacks and dividends starting in June. And all of a sudden, it seems like those financials, which we were rightfully concerned about 6 months or a year ago, remember that financials were the thing that took us down in the last recession. You know, all those things that we were concerned about with financials this time around, I think are starting to maybe be the thing that's setting them up for a nice little run here. And you look at other cyclical areas of the market, you look at other areas that were maybe a little less attractive. What's wonderful about these developments is that, you know, last year the returns we saw were so concentrated. It was a small handful of stocks that did all the heavy lifting. This year, yeah, that small handful of stocks is taking a step back. We see it in the NASDAQ's returns, but you have much broader participation now, and maybe not from areas that most people were expecting. And so, you know, Dave, I think, you know, one of the benefits for investors that don't try to figure out, okay, what's the next right place to be is, you know, that you get to participate no matter what. We've always been a little bit heavier in growth stocks, at least the last 3 or 4 years, because that's where a lot of the opportunity was. I think the difference is we didn't find a lot of places that overweighted just those 4 or 5 names. And so, you know, investors, and I'm sure you're getting this question now from investors who are looking at the market and going, whoa, why is it selling off? Yeah, we've seen sell-offs here and there, but we're also getting broader participation than what we got in the past in the rallies.
Which is always encouraging, Kyle, is that, you know, obviously you get a little concerned when, you know, we've seen some of this pattern in the past few years where you get 5, 6 names that are responsible for majority piece of the earnings in the market over short periods of time. And we saw that with some of the FANG stocks recently. So yeah, the broader participation is always a great sign, and it will lead to some rotation as we're starting to see it from growth to value. But to your point, is not about making a bet. And I don't want to caution people to think that growth's days are over and it's time to completely unwind your growth portfolio and go all value. You know, Joel, you shared FactSet publication numbers with us today, and there was an interesting highlight in there about how the growth sector is actually year-over-year growth projections, the revisions are substantially higher than the other sectors. So even though growth stocks are feeling a little unloved right now, those companies are feeling pretty confident about their earnings forecast going forward here. So while they're maybe taking a breather for a while, I don't know if it's necessarily time to abandon that sector for sure.
And Dave, maybe stress that, you know, corporations right now are sitting on huge piles of cash. A study from PricewaterhouseCoopers showed that there's about $7.6 trillion in cash and short-term equivalents on corporate balance sheets right now. And the reality is that many of those growth names with super high octane growth forecasts also have large piles of cash, whether that's the Apples of the world and the Microsofts of the world, or whether it's, you know, some of the names that maybe are thought of, a little less off the top of your head. But that cash has to go somewhere. It's not going to be sitting in the banks. It's not going to be, going to short-term investments that are paying nothing. Yeah, it will for a little while, but we've already seen this year an uptick in mergers and acquisitions. We're continue to see a pretty heavy flow into the IPO market. And so there's a lot of activity. And Paige, maybe this is a great place for you to jump back in. There's a lot of activity that suggests that people, you know, whether it's CEOs of corporations or whether it's individual investors, are feeling a little bit better about the path forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you see that across the board, right? Even just looking at, you know, whether we're talking about individual investors or more of the institutional side, just over the past 6 months, expectations for earnings have been revised up about 8%. So that alone in and of itself is a pretty big jump when you're looking at the expectations for earnings. Now, of course, when you have that much cash, not only on the corporate balance sheets, but also the personal balance sheets, the other question that I'm getting a lot is inflation. And I think that is a big concern for a lot of people. And, you know, as we come out of this, as interest rates continue to be as low as they have been, is that going to be a big issue? Now, I know you know this, but really there's two kinds of inflation. You have the price push. So you have higher prices causing higher prices to the rest of the market. And then you have that demand pull side of inflation as demand starts to rise. And I think most of the concern is on that demand side. As we come out of the pandemic, people want to start spending more. They want to put that cash to work. On the personal side, you know, that will lead to inflation. But at the same time, we have all that corporate cash. We have a lot of extra capacity on the production side. And so the expectation is, even though we might see some of that inflation, we have that extra corporate capacity to get back and keep up with it. So all of those things, I think, bode well for the market overall.
You know, Paige, such a great point. And it's why we use the word transient when we talk about some of our expectations for maybe a small pop in inflation near term. You know, the response from corporations is, oh, if I can make a little more money, I'll sell a little more product. And by flooding the market with a little more product, you've kind of done the opposite and pushed prices back down. And so, you know, things like a ship stuck in the Suez Canal, well, that's going to hurt supply short term. And that's an issue that we have going on at this exact moment that they're trying to deal with. And you've got chip makers in Asia that are having a hard time getting their silicone to the U.S., you've got, you know, electric vehicles that rely on those chips that are shutting down production lines because they now aren't going to be able to get them as quickly as they thought they were. But at the same time, those are short-term problems. And as you say, we find ways to, especially with the amount of cash that's on the books right now, we find ways to solve those problems. Capitalism fills in those gaps and finds ways to make money. So I think that's such a great point about kind of the direction we're headed here. Joel, we've got quite a bit of economic data this week. You know, the big headline number that everybody looks at, obviously, is GDP, but there's a lot more under the hood there.
Yeah, Kyle, the GDP number actually was the third update for the fourth quarter. how fast the economy was growing. And we found out that it actually was growing faster than we thought before. It was growing at a 4.3% annual rate. And they had estimated that it was 4.1% just before that. And that's looking at kind of how fast it's going those last 3 months. But if you measure it year to year, our GDP is still 2% behind where it ended 2019. It's at the level that it was at the beginning of, you know, in the middle of 2018. So, you know, we're still behind there as far as, you know, our economic output. The numbers we had earlier in the week, and this is kind of interesting and relates back to inflation. I think an interesting story to watch on inflation is what's happening with housing. We had numbers on existing home sales and on new home sales, and they both were down in February, but they're both at, you know, 14-year high levels or near, you know, where they were before the last recession, before the financial collapse in 2008. So that's interesting. But the thing that's starting to hold that back is supply. We've been hearing for a long time that, especially from realtors, that there aren't enough houses for sale on the market. The realtors said this week that they have 1 million houses, ready to sell. That's only a 2 month supply of houses, and both of those are record lows. The new home sales numbers from the Department of Housing and Urban Development also showed that they're very low. They're in February, the time on market for a new house was the lowest it's been in all the data that goes back to 1975. For the month of February. So, you know, we're seeing there some constraints, and yet we're also finding that there's demand. So as a consequence, the price keeps going up. The realtors said that the median price for a house sold in February was up 15.8% from the year before that. And that was the 108th month in a row that year-to-year prices have increased. So it'll be interesting to watch that to see if, you know, as you're saying, that the capacity will catch up with that, or that the demand will slip off. One other thing. So in both the gross domestic product numbers and numbers that came out today on personal spending, we saw what Paige was talking about as far as personal savings. And I was looking at this before, and personal savings, if you adjust for inflation, people have more than $1 trillion more right now than they had before the pandemic. And that's, you know, and it's in part because they have had restrictions on spending. You know, they haven't been able to go out and spend their money as they used to. And some of it is you know, being conservative and worrying about what's coming. So they've set it aside. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that as the economy continues to recover.
And Joel, I think the other thing to consider in those numbers is we still haven't felt in those numbers the full impact of this last stimulus passage. So those checks aren't considered in those numbers just yet, at least not fully. So, you know, we're talking to, you know, everybody else getting another $1,200 check here into these cash numbers. It's going to be a while before we unwind that cash backlog, and that could be fuel that could drive an economic recovery for quite a while.
If there's a University of Michigan survey that's done twice a month on consumer sentiment, which is considered sort of a leading indicator for consumer spending, and what they found in their report today was that all the indicators show that there's going to be robust growth in personal spending because of exactly what you're saying, and people feeling more confident just with the vaccine rollout. But they're saying that how long and how far that spending goes depends in great deal on how fast people are drawing down those savings.
Joel, we got a reprieve from the IRS, at least for a month here, on our filing deadlines for federal taxes. And I know you put a little something in the newsletter on that, but care to just update our listeners on what's going on with their tax returns?
Sure. Yeah. The bottom line is the deadline is now May 17th and instead of the traditional April 15th. That's both for the federal income taxes and the state income taxes. But two caveats. One is that if you're making estimated quarterly payments, those are still due on April 15th. And if you expect to get a refund, you should still file, as soon as possible so you get that.
I know plenty of tax preparers who are grateful for the extra month to get this done. I know some professional organizations that include CPAs had asked the IRS for that extension, recognizing how difficult the timeline was going to be this year. And so, I think investors having a bit more time to gather, their information to help file that return is a good thing. And I think, ultimately, as you say, file as soon as you can, but you don't quite have to rush anymore. And if you're a procrastinator, you've got one more month now to get it done. Well, thanks for listening. We enjoyed doing the program for you, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.